Well, good day, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, and you gators and grannies to the Sunday afternoon edition of the Big Puzzle. My name is Barry Prince, coming to you live from my residence here in northern British Columbia, being broadcast on People's Internet Radio and also being simulcast on shakeandwakeradio.com. We are viewer-supported stations, folks, so if you like the content, please reach into your pocket and throw a few bucks into the kitty. I know the stations would really appreciate it. And I'm going to thank my producer for producing my show, because I always forget at the end to thank Stephen for what he's doing behind the scenes for me. Welcome to the show. Today I've got Alex Newman, who is an award-winning journalist, writes for Free American in the States. We're going to talk about the United Nations, and I've also added to the conversation Mr. Ron Stevens, who anybody who's listened to my shows in the past are well aware with Ron, knowledge of the United Nations. And that's what we're going to talk about here for an hour, is the United Nations involvement in just about everything we see going on in our world today. Welcome to the show, gentlemen. And I'm going to start with Alex. Maybe tell people a little bit about yourself, and we'll carry on from there.
Well, thank you very much for having us, Barry. It's a pleasure to be with you again. And so for me, I kind of became a UN wonk by default. I grew up in international schools, being brainwashed that the UN was this great, last great hope for humanity and peace and all this nonsense. And I believed that for a long time. And gradually, I started getting suspicious. You know, the governments of the world were pretty grimy, shall we say. And, you know, when you combine them all together, you think you're going to get something better. Well, no. But I came across a documentary that the John Birch Society had produced about the atrocities that the UN's so-called peace forces had perpetrated in the province of Katanga back in the 1960s, or even maybe it was the 50s or the 60s. Basically, this province had decided they didn't want to be part of the Congo because they didn't want to be ruled by a mass-murdering Soviet government-backed dictatorship. And so they declared their independence and decided they were going to be an independent nation, pro-Christian, pro-American, pre-enterprise system, all the rest of it. And the UN decided that that was not allowed, and so they sent in the peace troops and started slaughtering women and children and bombing hospitals. They bayoneted a 9-year-old boy, started shooting at civilian cars as they were trying to flee this fiasco, basically until the people of Katanga would agree to submit to this communist dictator that the Soviet Union was trying to prop up there. And so that kind of started my suspicions, and eventually I started working at the New American Magazine. I'm a foreign correspondent for the New American, so for the last 10 or 12 years, I've been traveling around the world to all these UN conferences to kind of see what they're up to and report back to the people of the United States and other countries who read our work. And it's really become a passion of mine. You know, I think the UN is one of the most important tools of the globalists, of the deep state, of the insiders, whatever you want to call them, this diabolical conspiracy to enslave mankind and remove our freedoms and turn good into evil and evil into good. And so I think it's important that they be exposed. And so I've been all over the world now reporting them. I was supposed to go to Chile in a couple of weeks for the UN climate summit, but they now moved that over to Spain. So I'll probably end up in Spain for that. But I can tell you, you know, the UN is a fraud piled on top of a fraud. It was always intended to be the world government. They're using any pretext that they can think of to advance that objective, whether that be the man-made global warming hoax or this false notion that they're going to bring peace or, you know, the excuse of terrorism. Well, you know, take your pick. They're using it. They're exploiting it to try to advance their agenda. And so I'm just delighted to have the opportunity to speak about them here because it's so important that people know the truth about the United Nations. Otherwise, it really does represent a significant threat to our freedom, to our countries, to our churches, to everything else. So.
Well, absolutely, Alex. I grew up the same way, thinking the United Nations was the answer to all problems in the world. But, of course, I've dispelled those beliefs now, and I think this is one of the most important conversations that we can have because, you know, there's a lot of people in our society even today, when they hear the word United Nations, they think of it's a good organization. So we need to dispel those beliefs, and I think this is going to be an interesting conversation. Welcome to the show, Ron, and why don't you have a quick say on what we're talking about here, my friend?
Well, I'm on the same plane as you guys. I'm just a little bit jealous. Alex is running all over the world. I used to be a reporter in Calgary, Alberta, way back in the 70s. I would just love to be running around the world with these guys. But But no, I think what you both are talking about is, you know, we were programmed through the Prussian school system, and I remember collecting for UNICEF when I was a little kid, and thinking, oh wow, peace and eradicate poverty. But you know, I think the three of us here, I could be wrong, but I know what happened to me. It's your gut instinct, not your mind. You know, they program the minds, but then your gut says something's not right here, which gets intelligent people to ask questions, because until you start asking questions, you're never going to go look for answers. And that's what they've done to the people. They've dumbed them down to the point they don't know how to ask a question anymore. They don't challenge anything. And we have to bring them up. But, you know, if you go all the way back in history, you know, what we have is we have it's an Antichrist movement. Luther outed these guys way back in the 1500s, and nothing's changed. You know, one thing I was reading that I found very interesting was that, you know, President Wilson, who was involved in putting the Fed in place, was running around after the First World War telling Americans they had to sign on to the League of Nations, which was the first crack at the world government, really. Mm-hmm. But the American people still had a memory in their minds of why they fought the War of Independence and the idea of giving up any sovereignty to some entity like the League of Nations was not palatable to the people. And Wilson's telling them, you know, if you don't sign on, we're going to have another, you know, another world war in the not too distant future, a major war. Well, how do you know that? Well, they told me. So the people that set up the Fed and the people that set up World War One and the rest of the wars and World War Two, these are the people that have killed hundreds of millions of innocent people in order to move their agendas forward. And we need to put a stop to it. Because do you want a world government who killed hundreds of millions of innocent people, having complete and total control over every aspect of your life and all the resources of your nation? We don't want to go there, right? We can't go there. But I have a couple of questions for Alex, which I've been asking Americans for a long, long time. You have Trump in place, and, you know, as far as I'm concerned, he's a player. But at the same token, he's putting a pause on this, which is very, very important. And but my question is that in America, and the problem is both America and Canada and every other nation on the planet are all corporations. So they're really not our nations. They're just corporate entities. Had they been our nations, then we could have eradicated this stuff real quick. But my question really is that we have the Trilateral Commission, the CFR, and the United Nations is actually sitting on American soil. And, you know, I'm waiting for Trump to, you know, you have a right as the president to remove any threat to your nation, whether it be inside or outside threat. And the fact that the Trilateral Commission is still operating, it really raises some questions. And the fact that the United Nations is sitting on American soil. Now, I'm not sure if the United Nations is actually a separate entity outside of the United Nations actually sitting on United Nations soil or not. But the fact that it's there raises some serious questions. So I don't know what your thoughts are on those two entities, and the CFR is another entity that's, you know, they rolled the Trojan horse in, kind of thing.
The CFR was originally created right after their failure to con us into the League of Nations. They decided, oh my goodness, these Americans are so obsessed with their independence and their sovereignty and their self-government that we can't get them into this League of Nations. Well, hey, we need an organization to move this process along. So in 1921, with money from Cecil Rhodes, you know, a lot of this history is actually in an incredible, incredible book called Tragedy and Hope that was written by an insider back in the 1960s. He talks about the CFR was basically the American outpost of the roundtable groups set up by Cecil Rhodes, you know, the guy who made all this money in South African mining and gold and all this stuff, who really set out to destroy the Boer republics before he set out to destroy the United States. He had this crazy idea that we ought to have a world government and that the British ruling elite ought to be in charge of it. And so the CFR was really part of this effort all along. And to this day, it is probably the foremost force in the United States pushing for globalism. The Trilateral Commission is very important, but it goes beyond the United States. You know, the Trilateral Commission ropes in the Europeans and also the Japanese into this effort. But, you know, as far as the UN being on U.S. soil, we've been working to fix that for a very long time. Technically, they don't consider themselves to be part of U.S. soil. You know, they consider their compound to be international territory. And that's been my experience wherever the UN sets up shop. You know, we went to the UN Climate Summit in Paris in 2015, and we had an agent of the mass murdering communist Chinese dictatorship following us around taking pictures of us. And, you know, obviously that's okay in communist China, but in a civilized country, that's not how we do things, right? You don't intimidate journalists. You don't try to scare journalists and terrorize journalists in free countries. And so it was absolutely inappropriate. So we went and tried to file a complaint with the French law enforcement. And so we went to the French Interior Ministry, and they said, oh, sorry, that's UN territory. There's really not much we can do. You know, we'll take your complaint, but we can't investigate. We can't arrest anybody. Even if we could arrest anybody, they all have diplomatic immunity, so we can't arrest anybody. And plus, that's UN territory. And even just recently in Utah, a good friend of mine, Debbie Bacigalupi, was at this summit that they had in Utah, and she recorded a UN, quote-unquote, police officer saying, oh, this isn't U.S. soil. This is international territory, and we'll tell you, you know, you can't film here. We'll tell you what you can and can't do. So that's the reality. They like to think of themselves as, like, this above the law. You know, nobody can search them. Nobody can tax them. Nobody can arrest them. They all have diplomatic immunity. But there is a bill in our Congress right now. It's called H.R. 204, the American Sovereignty Restoration Act. I actually interviewed one of the chief sponsors. His name is Representative Thomas Massey. He's a congressman from Kentucky. Great, great bill. It's actually not his bill originally. Ron Paul used to introduce it. Even Congressman Larry McDonald, who was the chairman of the John Birch Society until he was until his airplane was shot out of the sky by the Soviet Union back in 1983. This bill has been around for a long time. But right now, it has a lot of momentum because of Donald Trump being in the White House. You know, previously, even if we were able to get this bill passed by Congress, which, you know, so far they haven't been able to vote on it. The establishment members on the Foreign Affairs Committee keep it bottled up. But previously, even if it were to pass, even if somehow it made it through the House and the Senate, it was almost guaranteed that the president would veto it. And to try to get a veto-proof majority on a bill like that would have been very difficult. But with Trump in the White House, it's a different situation. He's been very anti-UN from the beginning. In fact, he's been ridiculing them on the campaign trail. He said the UN was against freedom. It was against America. He's talked numerous times about defunding it. And so this bill, it would terminate U.S. membership in the United Nations, and it would also remove the UN's headquarters from America. And, you know, there's several reasons why this is important, but I think one of the biggest problems with having the UN here is that it forces the U.S. government to allow terrorists and communists and spies and all sorts of criminals and crackpots into the United States with diplomatic immunity. So these people just drive around the United States doing whatever the heck they feel like it, working with terrorist groups, working with hostile foreign governments, spying on our companies, and they say, oh, I'm a UN diplomat. I have diplomatic immunity. You can't mess with me. And that's simply unacceptable. It's grotesque. You know, they beat their servants. They beat their slaves. They abuse children. And nothing can happen to them because of this diplomatic immunity. So I think it's a very important part of the bill that often gets overlooked. And it's called the American Sovereignty Restoration Act. And the goal is to restore American sovereignty. But it would have this added benefit of getting this nest of terrorists and gangsters and mass murderers and pirates out of our country. And, you know, again, they're especially dangerous because of this issue of diplomatic immunity. And if we could arrest them for their crimes, it wouldn't be as big a deal. But, yeah, I think it's really important to kick that. I always say, you know, Havana is nice this time of year. Tehran, you know, maybe Pyongyang. Pick a better place. Come on, you don't need to have that here in our country.
Well, we can't move forward with our nations as long as this entity exists. We have to get rid of it. No ifs, ands, or buts about it. I mean, they, you know, it was our forefathers that came to these lands, Canada and the United States, or America. I hate saying the United States, America, came here specifically to get out from underneath the boot of tyranny. And they didn't want the foxes, weasels, and the snakes in their new house. And unfortunately, over generations, as our forefathers passed away, the snakes, the weasels, and the foxes, through the, you know, the deception of benefits, have taken complete control of our house again. And we got to run them out, you know. It's, you know, the enemy is inside the gates. Anytime I listen to Nancy Pelosi, I just about throw up. You know, you hate America, you know. If you hate America, then leave, right? You know, just, you're not welcome here. Go away. And a question for you, Alex, is how well informed do you think the Army, Navy, and Air Force, do you think that they get any of this stuff? I mean, you would think that the Army, Navy, and Air Force of America would turn on these people and basically round them up and run them out, or jail them, or do whatever to them, because, you know, because it's all been internationalized now. And we're not protecting our own territories the way we should be.
Yeah, it's a very good question, and I think it really depends. In fact, just 2 days ago, I gave a talk, and I had a member of the Special Forces in the United States come up to me, and it was very clear that he understood all of this and much more. And, you know, that's always encouraging, and there's a lot of guys like that. I mean, a lot of guys like that in the armed forces. There's also, though, the problem of the leadership. You know, during the Obama administration, there was an enormous purge of our senior officers. I don't know if they reported much on it up in Canada, but they got rid of huge numbers of the highest-ranking officers. And they've been very strategic about this for a long time. They've been giving questionnaires to the soldiers. Would you fire on Americans if you were ordered to? Would you confiscate weapons if you were ordered to? You know, questions like this designed to see where their loyalty is. Because, you know, every member of our armed forces takes an oath. And the oath is to the U.S. Constitution. It's not to a particular person. It's not to a political party. It's not even to the U.S. government. It's to the U.S. Constitution. And they're held to that. You know, if they're given an unconstitutional order, it's not just their right to object and to resist. It is their duty. In fact, they can be prosecuted under the U.S. Code of Military Justice for defying the Constitution, for obeying unconstitutional orders. And a lot of them understand that. But the problem is there's an enormous amount of ignorance in our society, and the establishment has been very strategic about cultivating an officer corps at the higher levels that is loyal to the establishment rather than the Constitution that they swear an oath to uphold. And, you know, the military is typically much more conservative, much more pro-America than the political class, even than the average population, you know, even than the average American. And that's well established now. It has been for a long time. But it's a tricky question. And, you know, they try to recruit them into their organizations. A guy that I can think of is Admiral Chester Ward. He was recruited. He was an admiral, you know, the highest ranking official, the highest ranking title you can get in the U.S. Navy. And he was recruited into the Council on Foreign Relations. Well, after 16 years of membership in the Council on Foreign Relations, he got out, and he actually blew the whistle. He worked with Phyllis Schlafly, a pro-family conservative leader in the United States, and exposed all this. And he talked about how they had this obsession with really ending the independence of the United States and merging us into an all-powerful world government. Just phenomenal whistleblowing that he engaged in that really was tremendously helpful to exposing these people. So I think that's one of their biggest concerns. It's interesting. You know, the establishment is walking a very fine line here. And it's the same with police officers, you know. There's a lot of police. And this came out when Obama started threatening gun control during his administration. You had sheriffs, for example, all over this country. In some states, literally every sheriff in the entire state said, you try that here, and your minions are going straight to jail. There's no way you're going to be confiscating any guns from the law-abiding citizens of my county. So they always have to walk this fine line. You know, they have the loyalty of the military and law enforcement up to a point, but they push it too far, and they lose it. And so, and I think that's one of the things that has kept America free, the fact that we have this decentralized system of law enforcement where the county sheriff is our highest law enforcement officer in a given county, and the patriotism of our armed forces, who really do, generally speaking, love America, support freedom, and you know, they really don't approve of this stuff that the politicians are doing. So I think that's one of the big things that we have going for us. You know, there's a lot of people in the armed forces who are patriotic, who understand some of this stuff, and that's you know, that's really, really, really good news for us. We need to keep working on that. I mean, we need to keep educating our officers, our law enforcement, our soldiers. But we are making progress, and that's very good. So.
Yeah, because the other problem we have, both your side of the border and our side of the border, is that every single municipal hall, be it called town hall, city hall, whatever, are all implementing the UN agendas into the municipalities, without the knowledge or consent of the people. Most people think that their municipal government, be it city or town, that their job is to collect the taxes and use the taxes to repair the roads and keep the parks clean and so on and so forth. But they don't realize that their actual tax money is being used to undermine them without their knowledge or consent, which again is a breach of trust, which equates to fraud, which is against the law, and that's a huge problem. I ran in the 207 provincial election up here, and I didn't want to, but I wasn't allowed on a mainstream radio show. A guy told me there's no effing way I'm ever getting on radio, and so I phoned the election office, and I told the lady there, the head, I didn't want to do this, and she told me I had to, and I said, why? And she said, somebody has to. I said, is that bad? And she said, you got no idea how bad it is. So I went out. That was the last day I could get the paperwork, ran out that night, got some names and that, and a lot of people can't do a simple thing like print your name, your address, and sign it. They screw it up, and so I decided to grab some extra names. And I saw a police car at a drive-through at the Tim Hortons coffee shop. So I went over and banged on his window and threw my clipboard in on his lap, kind of startled him. And I told him to put his name, address, and sign it. Then he asked me what it was about, and I said, I'm in a big hurry. I don't really have time to explain. Just do it. And he said, if I knew what it was. So I told him I was running the election. He said, I'm going to sign this. You want to know why? I said, not really. And he said, I'm signing this because I believe you have it in you to make this a better place and turn a better country. Which was nice of him to say that. But after that, once I started outing some of the negative things going on in the municipality, I've been arrested. I've been assaulted. I've been thrown in jail. And that's just intimidation tactic. I don't intimidate. It's the fact that this is going from the ground up and the people don't really know about it. How do we get to the people? I mean, I've done some public speaking here and there, that I've been invited to. But the number of people that show up, are not huge. The people, and mostly older people that show up, but they don't seem to understand that, you know, I call this, and I think you would agree with me, this is a spiritual psychological war that people really can't see. Because as Warburg said in 1950, we're going to have a world government by consent or by conquest. And they have our people here in the West consenting to it through all this love and, you know, anti-poverty and all this kind of nonsense that they're throwing around, all this propaganda. And they have us actually consenting to our own demise. They can't come up with a plan to legitimize the bombing of the West. So they have us consenting to it. And it makes it a very dangerous war, because it is really World War III. You know, three strikes and you're out. And we have to, you know, do our damnedest to get the information out to the people so that they stop hugging the enemy. And it's a very difficult process.
Well, I've always maintained that if everybody really understood what was going on in the United Nations and their agenda, you'd be compelled to stand up. Even if you didn't want to stand up, you'd be compelled because you'd realize the danger that's coming. But unfortunately, I see so many people in our society, they're apathetic. They just don't want to look at this, and I can't understand why. I know there's lots of reasons for that, but we have a problem right now, and this kind of a show is, I think, is very, very important, because this kind of conversation has to be had. It should be held at every dinner table right now across the country.
Absolutely.
And we need to get to that point, because what I see right now is a future coming that I wouldn't wish on my worst enemy. And, you know, I don't have a great education. I finished grade 9 in school, but it doesn't take a rocket science to really put all the pieces together and start looking at some of this information. And if it doesn't alarm you and get you involved, I don't know what to say to you.
Alex? Well, if we could educate the people, we don't have to fight anybody. You know, they want violence so that they can come in and say they're here to save us from the violence. So we can't give them violence. But the simple answer to this whole thing is that little wee word, no. Once we have enough people who get it, it's a simple fact of standing up and saying no. It's over.
What do you think?
It will be over, but it's to get to the people, and that's the difficult part.
Yeah, and I think that's the only way that this battle is going to be successful over the long term. And you know, I couldn't agree more. This really is a spiritual battle, and so part of this has to be, you know, relying on God as our source of strength, as our source of wisdom. And you know, I think the most important thing we could be doing in this battle as individual activists, aside from protecting and educating our own children, is educating the community. You know, we need to be finding ways to bypass the media, finding ways to bypass the censorship on social media, and get this information, get this truth out to our neighbors and to our churches and to our communities and to the opinion molders in our communities, you know, the talk show hosts, the legislators, city councils, you know, the people who really help shape the opinion in any given community. And that's, you know, nobody wants to hear that, because that's a lot of work. Everybody wants just a silver bullet that, hey, you know, we're going to just do this and then everything's going to be fixed. And unfortunately, it's not going to be that simple. You know, people say, well, we just have to elect the right people to Congress. Yeah, but, okay, that's true. But who's electing these criminals to our Congress? Who's electing these criminals to our parliaments? And it's the electorate, because we've been dumbed down. We've been we've become immoral. We've become sick. We've become easily manipulated. And so the only way to solve that problem is to work on the electorate. That is,
well, I have a plan that maybe you can put forward to your American folks, and we're working on it hard now up here. Is that there is an Achilles heel. And what people think is that the power lays at the federal and the state levels. But the real Achilles heel is at the local level, where your feet are on the ground, where you can talk to your neighbors. And it's a simple math system. We have to get control of our local councils, because only then can we say no to what the CAOs or the city managers who are trained, who are not elected, but are trained to implement the UN agendas. So it's really quite simple. If you have seven counselors, then you need to run three times that number. So you need to run 21 people who are well-informed, who have the knowledge, and then we can change the narrative during the election process. And you only need four to win seats to hold majority vote. So if we were to run three times the number of counselors, 7 equals 21, and surely to God we can roust up 21 people in our local communities who care about the future of their offspring, who will take the time to become knowledgeable to run in the election. But then you have that many people running, you have the opportunity to change the narrative. And your odds on winning those four seats that you require out of 21 candidates is extremely good. And as we take control of our municipal councils, it will snowball from there. And then it's a simple matter of saying no to the agendas. We're not implementing them into our, and we're not allowing them to be implemented. And then the power structure becomes ours.
And we idea very much, but I think we're still at square one. You know, the same people who elect the state representatives, or in your case, your provincial ministers, and the same people who elect the federal ministers, or in our case, our federal representatives, our senators, are the same people who elect the local councils. And as long as we have an electorate that doesn't understand these things, you know, that's the real hurdle we have to overcome. It's in America, we have a lot of great freedom fighters elected at the local, state, and federal level. But the bulk of our population, you know, they would agree with us if they knew. You know, the truth is very powerful and liberty is very powerful. The problem is that they don't yet know. And so I think, you know, educating the electorate will help us solve all of these problems, starting from our local communities and then spreading all the way up into the federal government. The problem is, you know, we've got to do the work of educating. Yeah.
Like, so we have no chance of getting control of the federal government. We have no chance of getting control of the provincial or state government. The only place we got a crack at getting control is at the local level. And, you know, this is not, you know, I talked to, and you probably run into the same thing, Alex, people just want this fixed tomorrow. Well, it took them a very, very, very long time to get us in the position they have us in now, and it's going to take some very hard work to flip this back the way it's supposed to be. And unlike our forefathers who were very strong of the spirit, mind, and spine, over the generations, they've turned it all into jello. But the upside is we still have the blood of our forefathers coursing through our veins. We just got to reactivate it, and we can fix the problem. But it's going to take time. We've got to roll up our sleeves, get to work, and be determined, and we can fix this.
That would be a subject for about a two-hour conversation, what you just talked about, Ron, how they got society to where we are today and how it's going to be fixed. So boy, they've sat in think tanks for how many years now, conceiving ways to attack our morals, to attack our health, to attack every aspect of what it means to be a human being. So we're at a point now, you know, it's funny they brought out that movie Zombie Apocalypse, you know, and everybody laughed and said, wow, that's funny. Society could never get to that point, but we're so close to that it's not even funny. And there's multiple ways they've done this to us, and it's going to take a lot of time to unwrap it. You're absolutely correct, but we've got to start somewhere. Conversation like this is a very good one to have. Alex, what do you think?
Yeah, I agree on all counts, and it is going to be a time-consuming process. You know, it is going to take educating our communities. It is going to take educating our families. And it's going to, and for a lot of people, it's going to be a long process. You know, they were brainwashed for 12 to 15 years in school. Then they're brainwashed every day by the fake media. So, you know, reversing that is not easy. But we do have huge advantages on our side. One of those is the fact that we have the truth on our side. And the other is that people have a natural affinity for freedom, right? People want to be able to make their own decisions. People don't want to be oppressed. And so the other side has to try to find ways to market lies and market tyranny. So, you know, I don't envy their position on that front. True, they have all kinds of money. They have all kinds of power. They have, you know, control of the education system and the mass media. But, you know, they still have this enormous disadvantage, which is, again, trying to sell lies. And you know, it takes billions of dollars to market lies and slavery, whereas freedom and truth kind of can stand on their own 2 feet without that kind of support. Right. But yeah, it is hard work. And so, you know, that's what we're doing. We produce publications. You know, the New American Magazine is the one I write for, and we've been at this for over 60 years now. The New American was the result of a merger between two previous publications, and the goal is, of course, to get this information out to the opinion molders and then ultimately have that trickle down to the public and create a more moral and a more well-informed electorate. And again, I don't know that there's any shortcuts to that process. So it has to be done. If we don't fix the electorate, we're never going to be able to fix the government. And so, yeah, that's what we're doing. That's what we've been doing. That's why I go to all these UN conferences, to find out what they're up to and to bring the truth back to the American people, because we know they're not going to get it from the fake media. We know they're not going to get it from their school system. So then where do you turn to get true information? And, you know, that's what we need to provide. We need to provide resources, materials, truth that people in our communities can distribute to other people so that we can gradually awaken from our slumber. But you're right, our forefathers did this, and they were successful. You know, in America, the founding fathers are still pretty highly regarded by at least the older generations. The younger generations have been brainwashed largely. You know, they were amazing men. They did great things. They created a free country. They went up against the most powerful empire in the history of the world and were successful. And, you know, that's all amazing. And so we do have that to look towards. But again, it's going to take a lot of education. And I think that's where we need to really concentrate our efforts.
Yeah, if our forefathers were alive today, boy, they'd be walking down the streets with guns in their hands, heading to the mainstream media outlets that are putting this stuff out in front of our faces today. I mean, they control every aspect of what people read and understand. I mean, a lot of people still turn on CBC here in Canada every night to get their source of information. And one quick note I wanted to bring to you guys' attention. I don't know if you're following politics up here in Canada at all, Alex, but election candidates released their official numbers for the votes casted in our federal election. And they're going to have some trouble explaining this, Ron. I don't know if you're following this story, but it is truthful that 35 million votes were cast on election night out of 27 million eligible voters that were eligible to cast the vote.
Are you serious? I knew there was 27 million voters, but you're saying 27 35.
It's on election. It's on Election Canada's website. This is really? Factual information, or I wouldn't be saying it. I've looked at it already. It's on their website. 35 million votes were cast out of 27 million eligible voters. There's going to be some explaining done on the next couple of days on this issue, but boy, I'll tell you, you know, I don't usually say stuff like this, but it is on their website, so you can go check it out yourself.
We know the elections.
Ron, if this is true, we're going to get another election. Instantly, it'll be recalled.
There won't be another election. There'll be some nonsense, but there won't be another election. Well, I can't see it, but
that's 8 billion, buddy.
Well, I mean, I ran for mayor in 2018, and the first thing they did was come and arrest me. And splatter my face all over the place, saying I was arrested for assault, even though I didn't assault anybody, and resisting arrest, and then they have the electronic vote on top of that, and it took me about a year, almost a year, to have the charges dismissed. Now, I suppose I could go and complain and try and get another election, but I know how these people are in protection mode, these municipalities, because they know exactly what they're up to. And when someone challenges them, they don't want the rest of the community to jump on board with the challenge. So
we got to bring this out to the public, Ron. So this is
I didn't know that. There's only 37 million people in the country, and you tell me there was 35 million people voted?
That's on Election Canada's website. Nothing would surprise me what's going on.
They were talking about dropping the voting age. Maybe they dropped it to 1.5. That would account for the vote.
Alex, are you following the circus up in Canada here and our prime minister at all? Are you paying much attention to what's going on up here?
Only from a distance. I haven't been in Canada for a few months. I was up there in Alberta not too long ago, and then I was up in British Columbia for some speaking events. But I don't follow Canadian politics probably as closely as I should, but I do know that your crazy prime minister got reelected, which is almost inconceivable to me. I wasn't aware of the allegations of impropriety. It doesn't surprise me, though. We're dealing with a lot of that in America, especially in jurisdictions run by Democrats like California. We know there's insane amounts of vote fraud, ballot stuffing, harvesting ballots, having dead people vote a bunch of times, having illegal immigrants vote. So it's a big problem in the United States, and it doesn't surprise me one bit to hear that similar shenanigans are going on in Canada.
But well, you must agree with this, Alex. I think you'll agree with this, that all of this is because, see, the globalists are now, they're not doing this, incremental stuff so much over generations. They're running for the goal line now. And the harder they run for that goal line, the more things they're doing that even the dumbest of the dumbest are scratching their head and what the hell's going on, especially with these people are not as bright as they should be, but they still know when these votes are illegitimate. And that, I think, is doing a big help to us that these people are starting to scratch their head now. Because the harder the globalists run for that goal line, I think the more people are starting to question and kind of wake up and start to look for some truth. And our job is to get it out to them.
I think that's critical right now. I'm going to follow this story some more, and I'm going to make sure that it's absolutely correct. But I've seen two posts of the information on the website. So unless somebody's fabricating this, these are correct numbers. And that's really got to get you scratching your head. But I know they also allowed people outside the country to vote in this election. They brought in all kinds of laws here in the last 3 or 4 years to make sure that Trudeau would get back in. I mean, for him to get back in power here, guys, it's unbelievable, because I believe that 8 out of 10 Canadians wanted this man removed, and here he is back again. So, and of course, he's going to be working alongside with the NDP, and the NDP will work alongside Justin Trudeau. We know they had a closed-door meeting about 3 weeks before the election, laid down the plan because he knew he was in trouble. Boy, are we in a fascist dictatorship. Unbelievable. Go ahead, Alex. What's your thoughts on that? Hello.
Alex?
Did we lose him?
Hey, sorry about that.
Well, there he is.
Yeah, sorry about that. I had myself on mute. I missed the question, though. We're still talking about voting fraud in Canada.
Yeah, I was just mentioning on exactly, what the laws this government changed in the last few years, how they came in on a promise of election reform. Of course, that was dropped. We're seeing a very fractured country now in Canada. The separatist movement in the West is growing at light speed. And I see all these guys jumping on board with that. And I'm going, wait a second, hold on, folks. If I was to take a page out of a globalist playbook that wanted us to divide this country, these would be the exact things that I would do to this country. I'd attack the energy sector. I would get the West absolutely enraged with the East. And now we see a mass separation movement, and people are jumping on board. Boy, talking about a knee-jerk reaction. I'm really kind of watching this from the outside right now because, to me, it's all part of a play.
I'm going to write a story on We Exit there. The Albertans from Facebook are going to jump on me hard, but they're going to have to work through the truth here. And what's going on with that exit deal is an absolute complete fraud. And unfortunately, people are frustrated and they're jumping on board without checking into the notes. So I'll be writing a story on that probably tonight or tomorrow and get that out to the people. They won't like it, but tough luck. Truth is truth.
Hey, Alex, what do you think of this charade going on in the States right now with all this impeachment inquiry? I mean, I'm following some of this, and it's lunacy. I mean, how can these people even proceed with something that has absolutely no merit to it, as far as I understand, and what I've looked into? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think it's really interesting that the whole impeachment thing started right after Trump's speech at the General Assembly. I don't know if you guys caught that, but in September, he talked about how the future doesn't belong to globalists. It's going to belong to patriots. And in America, our rights come from God. And regardless of what the UN thinks, that's how it's going to stay. And we're going to protect our gun rights. And we're going to protect our free speech, regardless of what you guys think about it. That was pretty incredible. And it was very shortly after that that they announced that, hey, we're going to be coming after you, and we're going to be having this farce of an impeachment. And they still haven't identified any real or imagined crimes or misdemeanors that he may have committed. So I think it's a fraud. I think, you know, they essentially want to get rid of him because he, in my view, really threatens their agenda. I know he's not perfect, and I know a lot of people wish he would do certain things differently, but he really has, in a very serious way, restrained the United Nations more than anybody in my lifetime, certainly, without any doubt. You know, he got us out of UNESCO, for example, the UN's education agency, which was huge. He's in the process of getting us out of the UN climate agreement, the Paris Agreement, which is huge. He's defunded multiple UN agencies. He got us out of the UN Human Rights Council, which is an enormous fraud that spends most of its time criticizing freedom anyway. So he's done some really good things there, and I think the globalists are now freaking out because they realize, hey, this is a guy who we can't control, who poses a threat to our agenda, and so they don't like it.
Mm. One of his first acts as president was to remove you from the United Nations Mass Immigration Pact. And we have our government just embracing this all hook, line, and sinker. I mean, immigration in Canada is completely out of control, and we got big problems. I know you have the same problems down at your border. But it's incredible what's going on at the border here in Canada, Alex. I don't know if you know what's going on in Canada, but the amount of illegals that are coming into our country, and a lot of them are getting in unvetted. And they're people coming from countries that don't have good intentions, but will never assimilate to our culture. Don't want to learn our language, don't understand our values, will never respect our values because they come from a part of the world where their thinking is completely different than ours. And that's something I am going to talk about in the next hour. I have Dr. Salim Mansour going to join me. We're going to talk about radical Islam and the tool it is for the United Nations, but we won't get into that conversation right now. But
on the immigration front, you know, it ties right back into the UN. One of the things that Trump resisted coming out of the United Nations was this international compact on migration. They actually negotiated that in Morocco. I was going to go to that conference, but I ended up going to the climate conference instead. But they came up with this deal where they said international migration was going to become a human right, and you had the right to move wherever you wanted, and criticizing mass immigration needed to be criminalized, and people needed to be punished for objecting to this. And,
right.
Just absolutely crazy. And Trump was the first leader to say, no, guys, sorry, but we're not going to do that. Absolutely, positively not. Immigration and border controls, that's a sovereign responsibility of the United States government, and we're not giving that to you. Forget it. And right after Trump said that, I don't know if you guys paid attention, but they started falling like dominoes. First it was Viktor Orban in Hungary said, hey, you know what? We're not going to do that either. Good, thank you. Then you had Switzerland and Australia and Chile and Brazil and, all the Croatia, all these different countries suddenly started, dozens of countries. It's all the countries that the UN wants to flood with migrants. Anyway, they said, well, hey, we're not going to participate in this. And so incredible, incredible development. I think we really should be encouraged by things like that. And it all happened because of President Trump. And the globalists lost their minds over that. They said, oh, he's anti-immigrant, oh, he's this, that, and the other. But, he did it. The American people supported it. And that was phenomenal. So,
Ron, what do you think?
Well, I know I read the New Century Initiative, which says that the population of Canada is going to grow to be 100 million people, which is all immigration, which will absolutely devastate. It will just remove the Canadian culture, everything from the country, of which we can't allow. I'm very disappointed that the police and the army, who both take a oath to the Queen or the corporation of the globalists, whichever one you want to call them, are not down protecting our borders. Our borders are flung wide open. And, we got a problem. We got a huge problem. We started a new outfit called The Reset. We're still working on the websites and that. And I was just talking to a partner of mine from Calgary before it came on the show. And she's going to be speaking in Calgary in the not-too-distant future. And we've been working on this for about a year now, and we're going to kick it loose and use it for an education process, I guess, for the Canadian people. Because, like Alex is saying, we got to get to the people. And, you know, the idea of social media and that is not the answer. You know, you can walk up and down any street in America or Canada and knock on a door and talk to people, and they're just going to look at you with deer, like, you know, deer caught in headlights. They're not going to understand what the hell you're talking about, because they're busy watching the TV and going to the movies and listening to radio and reading magazines and newspapers. They're so inundated with propaganda and lies that they accept as truths that if you walked up the door and told them the truth, they wouldn't know what the hell how to deal with it. So social media, while it, some people deal with it and understand it, the vast majority of the people don't go anywhere near, social media as far as, trying to figure out what the truth is. So we got to get to the people, and we got to get to them as fast as we can, or, you know, our country's screwed, and we can't allow that to happen. I have no intentions of allowing that to happen.
Well, I believe the window of opportunity is going to close in the very near future. And I agree with you 100%, Ron, that it's very, very critical now that we take every opportunity that we have to try and
reach. We're going to win this. I wouldn't be doing this if I thought we weren't going to win it. I mean, I first started telling people in the 1970s this was coming. They didn't want to hear it. Canada's the best country in the world. If you don't like it, get out, right? You idiots. But, you know, I just told them they're just softening you up, okay, with all these benefit, government benefits and that. They're just softening you up, so when they come at you, you're not going to know how to deal with it. And here we are. We're going to win this. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. Three strikes and you're out. World War One, World War Two, World War Three is a psychological, spiritual war, and that's the war we're going to win. And and we're going to make things right.
In the last couple minutes here, I just want to switch gears because we had a little conversation just before the show started, gentlemen, about Stephen Harper and the Bohemian Grove. And, Alex, you wrote an article on that. Do you want to just brief on that real quick? Because I don't think anybody in this audience has ever heard that before.
Yeah, so I'm very happy
to switch gears, but I want to talk about that for a couple minutes because we only got about 5 minutes left on the show. I'd like to take a couple minutes to talk about that, if you would.
Yeah, absolutely. So for people who aren't familiar with the Bohemian Grove, it's essentially a secretive gathering once a year in the Redwood Northern Forests of Northern California. And about 2,500 of the world's most influential men, and it's all men, right? Presidents, prime ministers, cabinet secretaries, you know, ministers in your case, you know, CEOs of the big banks and the big pharmaceutical companies and, you know, all these things. They get together once a year in these forests, and they do all kinds of occult rituals. You know, part of it is just kind of like weird. You know, they get naked and they run around and they pee on trees as a symbol of their freedom and this kind of kooky stuff. But then there's a darker side too. And Alex Jones, you know, the guy who hosts the InfoWars radio show, he managed to sneak in there some years ago with a camera, and he recorded some of what they were doing. It was pretty incredible. You know, I encourage people to go to YouTube and check out these, you know, these videos that he produced. It'll blow your mind. You know, they're walking around with hoods and weird stuff, and they're chanting about forest spirits, and they're standing in front of a 40-foot stone or concrete owl. Actually, I have a relative who's actually touched that owl because he worked as a contractor in preparing the venue. He wasn't there, you know, as an invited guest or anything, but really, really weird. You know, and for people who are not Christian, I challenge you to give me an alternative explanation. You know, what is this if not demonic, if not satanic? And so we've written about this extensively in the New American. We did a whole special issue in the magazine called The Deep State Pulling the Strings from Behind the Scenes. And in addition to exposing, you know, the Council on Foreign Relations and some of these better-known organizations, we also exposed groups like the Bohemian Grove, groups like the Skull and Bones, you know, which is a secret society at Yale University. Bush, George Bush and John Kerry, who ran against him in the presidential election, were both members. So, you know, when you dig just below the surface, you realize that we are dealing with a diabolical conspiracy that hates humanity, that hates freedom, that hates God. And you're right, they're going to lose. There's absolutely no question that they're going to lose, but they're going to cause a lot of pain, and they have caused an enormous amount of destruction in the meantime. So, you know, I think we all have a duty, an obligation to resist this.
Really, when you look at the people that have attended the Bohemian Grove and you look at some of the names on the list, it speaks volumes to where we are in the world today as a society. It's unbelievable that these world leaders attend this stuff. And I looked into it, and I believe it's called Athena the Owl. Am I correct in saying that? The statue that they...
Yeah, different people speculate that it might be different things. I know some people have suggested that it may be a representation of Moloch. Some people say, yeah, that's the end of the owl. So, you know, I don't really know for sure. What is absolutely crystal clear is that this is demonic and it's diabolical. And, you know, everybody who goes there doesn't necessarily understand that. But we know Stephen Harper was there, right? Somebody hacked into Colin Powell's emails, and he said, oh, yeah, I was just down at Bohemian Grove, and I got to sit next to Stephen Harper, and surprise, we all don't like Trump. Oh, okay, surprise, right? For me, that's about the best endorsement he could get. But it gives an insight into the minds of these people. And every Republican president in the United States, every Republican president going clear back to the 1920s has been to this disgusting Bohemian Grove meeting, with the exception of Donald Trump. So I think that speaks a lot for him. And again, I know he's not perfect. I know, you know, there's things he ought to be doing better. But you know, the fact that he's not involved with these weirdos and their weird little rituals, as far as I'm concerned, that is just an enormous step forward in where we need to be as a nation.
Absolutely. Well, gentlemen, that hour has gone. Unfortunately, I could carry on this conversation, I know, for another couple hours, but going to have to close out the first hour here. I want to thank you, Alex, for joining me, and Ron for stepping in and adding great thoughts to the conversation. It's been an absolute pleasure having you two gentlemen on today. And I know my listening audience...
enjoyed talking to Alex. And,
yes. And we'll have this conversation again in the future, gentlemen, if you allow me to put it together. I would love to carry
on. Hey, thank you so much. Really appreciate you having me. Have a good one. And I hope everybody will go to thenewamerican.com for more on these stories. And thanks again, Barry. Appreciate it. And thanks, Steve.
Thanks, Alex. And yeah, folks, go to the New American. There's awesome, awesome articles there and good videos to watch. Thanks again, gentlemen. We're going to take a break for a couple minutes. I'm going to go use the bathroom because I got a bunch of coffee going through me. And I'll be right back with Dr. Salim Mansour. We're going to talk radical Islam and how it's infiltrating our governments. Be back in a couple minutes. Welcome back to second hour, folks, and to say that I enjoyed that conversation the first hour would be an understatement, and I promise to get those two gentlemen back in here again in the near future to carry on that conversation. Like I said, we could have gone another 2 hours, but it's my honor and my pleasure to be joined by Dr. Salim Mansour, second hour here. He is a professor, I believe, at the University of Western Ontario. Have I got that correct, sir? I hope so. And has authored 4 books, and we're going to talk today about radical Islam, and we could talk about multiculturalism, a few other things Mr. Mansour has wrote about. Welcome to the show, sir, and thank you for taking time to join me today.
Barry, thank you for having me, and I look forward to this conversation.
Let's talk about radical Islam in Canada and how it is getting into our government and what we're seeing happen inside of Canada, because what I'm seeing right now is very, very disturbing, and I'd like to touch on that subject. And, you know, when we talk about this today, Salim, it doesn't matter if we're looking at Canada, the United States, the United Kingdom, France, the same agenda is being ramped up around the world. So let's talk about that for a few minutes and how it is infiltrating our society.
Yeah, absolutely. This is a global issue, a global phenomenon. Islam as a religion and a faith tradition, and I am a Muslim. I'm of a Muslim background myself. It's a global tradition, universal religion, as is Christianity, as is Buddhism. So the issue that we want to address, or you want to address, and I would like to talk about is Islamism. Islamism as a political ideology, that is the weaponization of a religion, in this case Islam, to serve a political movement, and that's where we are in terms of how this ideology, this movement is affecting our lives in Canada, our politics, and our future in Canada as it is in most of Western Europe or Europe at large. And in the United States, this is emanating out of the Middle East, out of the Muslim world, if you want a precise location, Saudi Arabia, historically in the 20th century. And in the last half of the 20th century, with the revolution in Iran, exactly 40 years ago, in 1979, when the Shah of Iran, a secular leader, was overthrown in a popular radical movement that was subsequently captured by the religious leadership and turned Iran into Islamic State, as it is called, an Islamic Republic. So this is a modern phenomena, and it has a global reach. To get to your audience very quickly, to put them into perspective, I would say that on 9/11, on September 11, 2001, 19 Saudi Arabian citizens, young men, 14 of them were Saudi citizens and the rest were Egyptian and Lebanese. They hijacked four white-bodied planes and flew it into the World Trade Center and West Wing of the Pentagon. And this was the most severe or bloodiest attack on America's heartland, as opposed to what happened in December 7, 1941, where Hawaii was attacked, which was part of the American Republic, but it was 3,000 miles from the American heartland in the Pacific Ocean. New York, America's greatest city, was under attack. And what happened is that instead of turning around and taking the war, or at least the punishment to the people who had planned, executed, and carried this out, United States and followed by the rest of the Western world just turned over, quarreled over, and basically went into appeasement, accommodated. And that you see is what has happened in the Western world. You know, we turned around to change our entire lifestyle, beginning with, you know, how we travel, how we go about our business on a day-to-day things. And right now, you know, I mean, the airport, it began all there, the body checking, you know, 80-90-year-old women on wheelchair being body checked before they pass through the airport to board their plane, or little babies with their mothers being body checked, and women and men. Instead of saying, you know, we know who the enemy is and we're going to go after them and we're going to see that they do not change our lifestyle, our way of life, we went 100 degree opposite. And that's the, I think the precise example that most people in the West should be able to recognize. But now this has become the new normal. I mean, if you talk to a 20-year-old Canadian or a 20-year-old American or a 20-year-old European or the millennial, they don't know the world that you and I, Barry, we knew, we lived, we traveled in. That was before 9/11. And the new normal is just the opposite. And in that little example lies the immense change that has come about, and more changes will come about as we concede to this push by the Islamists to change our way of lifestyle and to become more what technically we need to know is become more Sharia compliant. Sharia is the body of Muslim law, Islamic law, that was formulated in the Middle Ages or the early Middle Ages in the 9th, 10th, 11th century.
Right.
And that body of law by which most of the Muslim societies in the Middle East and Africa and Central Asia, they tried to live by. And you can see the utter dysfunctionality of those societies in terms of the modern world that we're living in. That's the body of law that is being pushed by the Islamists around the world and through the UN.
Right, I understand that. So explain to people your basis of belief as opposed to radical Islam.
Yeah, it's a very good question. Barry.
Because as soon as somebody hears the word Muslim, let me just add a thought. As soon as somebody hears the word Muslim, they automatically think, you know, the bad guys that are running around perpetrating all these acts of terror around the world. So explain to people the difference between what you live in your life and your basis of belief as opposed to radical Islam, and why radical Islam is so working so well to destabilize our society. Go ahead.
Right, exactly. Well, you see, Barry, what has happened, what the Islamists have succeeded, the political Islam has succeeded, the ideologists have succeeded over the last, half century, at least, and we can go further back and in this long discussion. You know, I tell my students always, to understand anything, you have to put it in context, in historical context. And so it is much of the 20th century. What they have succeeded in doing is making their view, their narrative, their ideology, the way in which not only increasing numbers of Muslims themselves have come to understand their faith tradition, but that the Western world or the non-Muslim world basically understands Islam, that is in terms of what the Saudis and the Iranians and their followers, the Islamists, have projected the narrative onto this historical tradition, which is Islam is a religion that is more than 1,400 years old. And very simply put, it is a monotheistic religion. It belongs to the part of the Abrahamic tradition, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. These are the three religions born in the Middle East, and they are all three share the same historical background, that is the Abrahamic family and Abrahamic monotheism, that is the worship of one God. And then there are theological differences between, say, Judaism and Christianity, vis-a-vis the personality of Jesus, how the Jews saw Jesus. Jesus, who was born among the Jews, to a Jewish mother within the Jewish tradition, and how subsequently, with the birth of Christianity, how the Christian world and Christology or theology of the Christian, according to the gospel or the four gospel of the New Testament, have portrayed Jesus, those are the theological differences. And then Islam, similarly, is the reaffirmation of the worship of the one God of Abraham, a message that was brought by Muhammad to his people among whom he was born, that is the pagan Arabs, and brought them a message which is in the Quran to worship the same God, the God of Abraham. And for the Muslim, the Quran is the sacred text, that is the revelation that the Muslims believe in, that was given to Muhammad. And when you read the Quran, you study, you look at the Quran and you go through the Quran, it is more or less the restatement of the Old Testament in the Quran. And then the central figures of the Quran are all the prophets of the Old Testament, and including, in fact, the most eminent prophet is Jesus, born of Virgin Mary. So this story is retold in the Quran to the pagan Arabs, to whom the faith tradition of Abraham and the worship of one God was then spread among today what is the Muslim world, that goes, stretches from Indonesia, on the Pacific Ocean, all the way to Morocco in West Africa, and then from Central America all the way into sub-Saharan Africa, this huge chunk of the world. And then in the 20th century, or in the second half of the 20th century, the beginning of the migration, the immigration process, which brought Muslims from all these various different parts of the world, and therefore ethnically different, linguistically different, but bound together as Christians are bound together by the faith in the Quran and Muhammad and the worship of one God. And as Christians, again, a universal religion from Philippines to Norway to Canada, vast diversity of the world, but bound together in the faith in Jesus as the Son of Man, Son of God, and the story of the gospel. So this is the fake tradition. And then, you know, you have the historical record of empires and rulers and kingdoms and so on and so forth, you know, before the emergence of the modern world, the rise of Europe, you know, the empires of Europe, the wars fought between Europe and the non-Europeans, in which the Muslims were part of the non-European world, the Middle East, you know, might go back all the way to the Crusades or after and so on. And so that is a very, very, you know, complex and complicated history that is there, to which different people look at it differently and draw different conclusions. But I would argue, and I would say, that it has nothing to do with faith, you know, nothing to do with the fundamental belief. The fundamental belief of a Muslim is in the worship of one God, and that Muhammad is his prophet. The fundamental belief of Christian is in the worship of Jesus. Jesus is the revelation, you know, and what is told about Jesus in the New Testament. And the fundamental belief of the Jews in the worship of the God of Abraham, you know, and the story of Moses and the tradition that Moses established. So in the case of Jews, the tradition that Moses established, in the case of the Muslim, the tradition that begins with Muhammad. And in the case of Jesus, you know, Jesus himself and the story of Jesus that is picked up later on with the conversion of the Roman Empire into Christianity, and then the spread of Christianity into what became Christendom and around the world. So these are the fundamental. And then what people do with these things for political purpose, for power, is a different thing, is a different story. And in the modern time, you know, after World War One, Barry, the part of the Muslim world, the heart of the Muslim world, which is in the Middle East, which was ruled by the Turks, the Ottoman Empire, was defeated. Ottomans, rulers, they chose to become allies of the German and the Austro-Hungarians in World War One, and as a result, they were defeated, and their empire was parceled off among the victors, that is, the British and the French. And then after the Second World War, that the British and the French withdrew, and those lands became, you know, independent nation states. And there emerged, you know, the struggle of establishing these nation states. And one branch of the country that emerged, at the heart of which was Saudi Arabia, they established the view, the rulers established the view, the ideology that this would be an Islamic kingdom, and the basis of rule would be the basis of rule that used to be there in the 9th, 10th, 11th century, you know, going back to what I said, the Sharia law, which is a pre-modern, you know, human construction. But that became the basis of the Saudi rule and of that part of the world. But the irony, and if I'm not getting too long away here, the irony is that the Western powers, led by the United States, embraced Saudi Arabia and defended Saudi Arabia and the Persian Gulf territory, because it was here that you had the discovery of the largest oil resources in the world, easily accessible. And, you know, the second half of the 20th century was the decades of the Cold War, containment of Soviet Union, communism, and for the Western powers, the defense of the Middle East, the defense of Saudi Arabia, the defense of the Persian Gulf was of very strategic importance against Soviet Union and communism. So under the cradle or under the cover, the support that the Western powers extended to this part of the Middle East, this 10th century ideology of Islam taken to defend the modern kingdom of Saudi Arabia emerged, grew, and was supported by petrodollars, and it spread. It spread under the wings of the Western powers until, you know, that's again another complex story, till what happened on 9/11, when these radical Islamists, these Muslims, fired up by the zeal of spreading the message and the Sharia law, invaded or attacked America, you know, and brought those ideology right into American heartland and penetrated the American society and the Western society, the Canadian society, through the new immigrants who arrived here in Canada and through the institutions of those immigrants, that is the mosque. And the mosque became the basic centers of spreading this ideology into our society. And they were provided the full cover, the full support under the terms of our democratic society, our willingness to accept immigrants, accept other people, and expect them to adapt to our values, in this case, Canadian values, American values. But that did not happen in the manner in which we expected that those values, our values, to be adapted. At the surface level, we all became Canadians, but beneath the surface level, the ideology of Islamism grew and spread, mm-hmm. and the politicians have gone to the mosque looking for votes, looking for support, and they in turn have made the bargain with the Islamists and given them the legitimacy, and now that is coming to haunt us because our politicians are now in cahoots.
Right,
these so, people.
Thus, the formation of the Muslim Brotherhood of American Care and organizations like that. The word Islamophobia being brought up and used to silence us against speaking against radical Islam. And in, Mr. Salim, one of the things that I've studied extensively in my life is 9/11 and the events that day and what actually happened on that day. And in my estimation, in my opinion, what happened that day was to create the enemy. Okay. Immediately after 9/11 happened, George Bush was standing on top of the pile of rubble and proclaiming to the world that we are going to go get these bad guys. You're either with us or you're with the enemy. Henceforth, they went into Afghanistan, and they're still in Afghanistan today.
Hey, Barry.
9/11 to me is the biggest false flag ever perpetrated on the human race, that there is nothing truthful in the government reports about how the events happened. And I challenge anybody to prove me different on that statement, but the exact same happened on December 7th, 1941, because I honestly believe in my research over the years, the government had foreknowledge of the Japanese attack. Henceforth, 3 days before the attack happened, they moved all the carriers out of Pearl Harbor, and they allowed the attacks to go on, because at that point, the American government realized that battleships were obsolete, but it perpetrated the agenda, and henceforth, they went into the war. We could talk about the Gulf of Tonkin incidents, the exact same thing, which has been proven to be a false incident, absolutely false. Yet 64,000 Americans went there and lost their lives.
Barry.
See the same thing happen over and over again. And I believe right now we could be seeing one of those happen real quick, Celine, because they want to get control of society. They're starting to lose it. Just my thoughts on 9/11. But
Barry.
To me, it's the biggest lie ever told to the human race, ever.
Barry, can I add something there?
Yeah, go ahead, Steve, if you'd like to make a comment.
Well, the actual seeds were planted long before September 11, 2001. They had been in Hollywood and entertainment demonizing Muslims starting back in the 1970s, but it actually started with the Muslim Brotherhood, started by the British MI5 and the CIA back in 1948.
Right.
Well, look, I mean, the history, as I said, of all of these things are very complicated, you know, the timeline itself, whether it was 1948 or whether it was, you know, in the case of the Muslim Brotherhood, the man who's the founder is Hassan al-Banna, he founded the Muslim Brotherhood in the 1920s. 1926 or something like that, 25, I'm talking now from the top of my head, but in the mid-20s.
Yes, oh, yes.
And the Muslim Brotherhood is the major Islamist organization in the Middle East. It was founded in Egypt during the interwar years, and then it grew. And it got ratcheted up as a result of the war in Palestine between the Jews and the Arabs, Palestinians. The Muslim Brotherhood took active part in it. And then subsequently, you know, the Egyptian government threw the Muslim Brotherhood out of the country, arrested many of these people. Hassan Banna was himself assassinated under mysterious conditions. And the main body of intellectuals involved with the Muslim Brotherhood, that is the leadership, they all went across to Saudi Arabia. And the long story, to put it in a capsule, is that Saudi Arabia was, in a sense, a client state of the United States. Franklin Roosevelt, at the end of the war, after the Yalta Conference, traveled secretly, which is all now documented, traveled secretly to meet with the Saudi king, the founder, King Abdulaziz ibn Saud, in 1945 after Yalta. And then he traveled back to America, and a few weeks later he died. But that embrace of Franklin Roosevelt and King Abdulaziz bin Saud, embrace, handshake, was the sealing of the relationship between the United States and Saudi Arabia that has carried on till our time. You know, despite 9/11, Saudi Arabia is and remains a very powerful client state of the United States. The other point I want to make very quickly, again, in this very complex storyline, that the last war or the last battle of this Cold War, which turned hot, was fought against the Soviet Union, and it became a graveyard for the Soviet Union, was in Afghanistan. That war began in 1979, and it ended in 1989 when the Soviet army withdrew from Afghanistan. The people who fought that war, later on they became the Taliban, the Soviet fighters, they're known as Mujahideen, they were fully armed and equipped by the Americans with devastating weapons that the Soviets could not counter, and the Soviet Union was the greatest land army in Eurasia, was defeated by these wild men in the mountains of Afghanistan.
Yeah, they got their butts kicked.
Yes, that's right. So you see, I have traveled in that part of the world. I've sat in those places, and I've seen what happened. I went there in the early 1990s. The point I'm trying to say is that the very people who, it is like, you know, going back to the Greek mythology, sowing the dragon seed. The dragon seed was sown, and the warriors that rose up from those dragon seed that defeated the Soviet Union then turned around and attacked America. I mean, Al-Qaeda, Osama bin Laden, all of these people were in Afghanistan, and Afghanistan became the nest, the snake pit out of which emerged these people that attacked the United States. Now, it will be long debated, Barry, and I don't think you and I have the interest to debate these issues. On my part, I have no interest whether it was a false flag operation or not. But the fact remains that this happened, and the Western powers in the last 20 years have, instead of taking these people out, taking action against these people, these ideologies. Remember, during the Cold War, we insulated ourselves from the communist ideology. You know, I mean, communism as a academic subject, people talked about it and wrote about it and taught it at the colleges and universities. But, you know, we saw the Soviet Union as an enemy, and we took action. But here in this case, this global ideology of Islamism, instead of taking action against it, which we have the full capability to do it, we have turned around and gone into full Monty appeasement and accommodation. Right. And this is where Europe is, and now Canada is, and United States is.
Pandering. And we see it ramping up. And, you know, when my last thought on 9/11, Salim, is that that event took away so many people's freedoms under the guise of protection. We look exactly. Homeland Security was formed. The TSA was formed. The Patriot Act was ruled in big time, although it was right place prior to 9/11. To me, sir, that, all history, and I'm not a historian, but I've studied the Gulf of Tonkin, I've studied the main event and the Spanish War, and how all these events seem to, just take away our freedoms under the guise of protection. And that's what I really see was the purpose of 9/11, and it worked very well.
It did. And in Canada, all of that you mentioned now extended all the way to now contracting, constricting, and abridging our freedom of speech, freedom, to speak and write and think about it. That is a direct assault on our way of life. Because once, you take control of what we think, what we speak, then everything else then follows from there. And that is what has happened with Motion 103, this whole notion of any discussion of Islam and Muslims can be defined as Islamophobia. And then those engaged in such discussion can be deplatformed, they can be censored, or even worse, they can be taken to Kangaroo Court like Ezra Levant or Mark Stein. It happened right in your backyard in British Columbia, the BC Human Rights Court. So, and these are going to worsen. These are not going to become more less, but it'll increase because all of these things are being packed and packaged through the United Nations into our own system of laws. And as a result, we are conceding to the pressures, to the extent that there is pressure, to the pressure that has been brought upon Western democracies through the United Nations. I would qualify myself. It is the people of Western democracies. The elite of Western democracies are in full cahoots with this program of taking control, more and more control, and less freedom to the people of Western democracies.
I couldn't agree with you more. It's an agenda that's right in front of our faces, yet people's lack of knowledge is that what I see as the main problem. I've said this many times. I think if people were fully aware of what was going on in their world and they weren't going to CBC or CTV or CNN in the States for their sources of information, you would see the rise that we need to stop this, Salim. But I see Canadians, I don't know what's wrong with Canada. I really don't. I look at our forefathers and what we fought for and what Canada is today. I see a bunch of apathetic Canadians that just don't want to get involved. I don't understand that myself, because what I see right now is the most important thing in my life that I can focus on, and having these conversations are some of the most important conversations that we can have.
Well, Barry, from my perspective, and looking at it in scholarly terms, that is in terms of philosophical and historical terms, what has happened, to put it in a capsule version, over the past half century, going back to the mid-60s, the Western elite, and here we are talking about Canada, the Canadian elite, basically started giving up on their own people, that is giving up on their own nation state and turning their back on the nation state. It all began with in Canada. We can in fact pinpoint it, and I've written a book about this, but I've been deep platform and nobody will discuss it in the Canadian media, that is the mainstream media. I was told about that directly by the people in TVO, which is the public broadcasting system in Ontario. Television Ontario. I was told by the people that they would never invite me or never call me to discuss my book, Delectable Lie, which won the best book award in the United States a few years ago. And so we can pinpoint it. It begins with in the early 1970s with the adoption of multiculturalism as a policy.
Right.
And then you can trace the whole argument, you know, what is multiculturalism, what was the policy, and then the various stages, the mutation of that policy as it evolved till where we are now, you know, where it began with Pierre Elliott Trudeau, multiculturalism that is based on the idea or the notion that all cultures are equal and all cultures deserve equal respect and equal treatment.
Right.
It was a very innocent sounding statement, but I'll come back to that in a moment. So that was Pierre Elliott Trudeau, and, you know, almost 50 years later, his son, who happened to again turn up, get reelected, starts saying that Canada has no core identity and Canada is a post-national state, you know. So you can directly draw the line of how from all cultures are equal to Canada has no core identity, which is where we have come to, that the elite has turned their back on the Canadian people, Canadian history, Canadian tradition, and in turn has embraced the notion of globalism, which you were talking to with your previous guest.
Right.
That is the founding idea of the United Nations in a borderless world, and that's become the instrument of the Western elite to push that UN agenda down onto the people of Western democracies, the advanced democracies. So what was a very innocent-sounding premise that all cultures are equal, but it is a flat-out lie. I think anybody who has even half a brain tied behind their back, as Rush Limbaugh says, would know that this is a lie. All cultures are not equal. The culture of Taliban is not equal to the culture that puts man on the moon, that decodes genome, that, you know, has created the modern world, you know.
Exactly.
The culture of people who worship stone idol is not equal to the culture that, you know, puts, you know, has Sir Isaac Newton, defining what becomes the basis of understanding the modern world in terms of science, you know.
Absolutely.
So this whole notion that all cultures are equal was the beginning of basically stripping away the Canadian identity, you know, the culture of what Barry, you would say would be your ancestors, the people, you know, who migrated out of impoverished Europe at the time, you know, 17th, 18th, 19th century Europe, whether it was the Irish potato famine, you know, or the religious wars or other disasters. And they migrated out of that part of Europe as pilgrim fathers, as pioneers, and, you know, as settlers to the new world. And there, here in the new world, built the most amazing, amazing civilization. And then to turn around and say, you know, our civilization, that is what was built, you know, over the last 400 years or more, is no different. Has no, you know, specific uniqueness to it than, say, the cultures of people who are coming. I came to Canada from India, you know, so to say from India, you know, even though India has a 5,000-year-old history, but I would say modern India, the India of the last 200 years or 300 years, and specifically the India that became independent in 1947, is not a product of Indian civilization. It is a product of the British, you know. It is the British who built modern India. And here I am, you know, I was born in Calcutta. My ancestors, my people, you know, I trace my origin back in Indian history. And here I'm sitting and speaking to you the language of Shakespeare, you know, and I am fully familiar with, and I honor the progeny of Queen Victoria, in the sense of the people who built modern India, who gave India its sense of an identity, which today makes India the world's largest democracy and so on and so forth. But I wouldn't say that that India and the culture of that India happens to be equal to the culture of the people who built Canada, who built the United States, you know. And then you can strip this into, you know, any number of ways you want to strip it to look at the world in cultural term and anthropological term and historical term, and you see how absurd the notion of multiculturalism is. But having said that, how absurd it is, we embraced it. That is, the Canadian people embraced it, you know, without examining its consequences, without examining what it means in action. And what it turned out to be was, in a way, stripping away piece by piece over time what is the essential Canadian identity, Canada built by settler communities of European origin, you know, to which
absolutely
to which a culture and a country that was so built so wonderfully with such great civility and decency and with such attractive qualities that it became a magnet for people from around the world to come to this country, wanting to come to this country, wanting to become Canadian. And yet, you know, it was our leaders started turning its back on that history, on that tradition, on that values.
Absolutely. And, you know, if you look back at immigration, you know, in the early days, people came to Canada knowing that they had to work, that there wasn't a meal ticket sitting here waiting for them, that they had to assimilate, they had to learn our language. And that's what made Canada what it was. And I'm saying what it was because it's not the same country that I grew up in now. It has changed radically. And you're right. You know, I think back to childhood, Salim, and, you know, my father, I think I was about 10 years old when Pierre Elliott Trudeau became prime minister, maybe even 8 years old. And he said to me back there, and I laughed back then, but he said to me, Barry, this man is going to destroy this country. And, you know, back then, of course, I didn't understand what he was talking about, but I really praise his insight. He saw what was coming. And that rings true to me today. The statement to me that this man was going to destroy the country. Well, Pierre Elliott Trudeau laid down the foundation for where we are today. And correct. Everything you've said, I agree with you 100%. You know, there's nothing that you said here in the last 10 minutes that I don't agree with.
Yeah, so you see what I was trying to get across again in a very capsule version is Canada has a history that is, you know, over 400 years. I mean, it was only a couple of years ago that Quebec City celebrated the 400th anniversary of the landing of Champollion, what was it, you know, I'm forgetting the name now. But anyhow, they celebrated the 400th anniversary of the founding of the Quebec City. And so it is even longer than 400 years, you know, but still 400 years. In this 400-year period, a great, great culture and civilization with its European origin was transplanted, nurtured, and built in North America and in Canada in terms of, you know, we north of the 49th parallel. But as you very correctly point out, the people who came here, they came through immense hardship. They made long journeys, and they knew that once they arrived, if they did arrive, if they were fortunate to arrive, having weathered the storm and the oceans and the seas, then there was no going back, that this would be the place where they would now be devoted to. This was where it would be their home, and this is where it would be their loyalty and so on.
Right.
You see, and then, I mean, the Trudeau period, the beginning of the Trudeau period coincide with immense changes that is taking place in the world. And what we are speaking about is the political and cultural side of it. So an open immigration policy was adopted in the mid-1960s, about the same time as Trudeau was coming into politics in Ottawa. And then he becomes the prime minister. But this is also the time, Barry, when communication and transportation globally was going through a massive shift.
Right.
And you have to imagine now how that affected us, that is Canadians and Canada and the Western world, alongside this ideology of multiculturalism as a public policy was created. What happened was that the new immigrants were not coming across the oceans in sailing ships through storm. They were flying across in wide-bodied jetliners. You know, I arrived from India in the early 1970s. You know, I flew out of India, but I was a war refugee myself. I was barely out of my 20s. I flew out of Mumbai. In those days, it was called Bombay. My flight flew from Bombay, and within a matter of several hours, I was in Toronto. You know, I landed in London and caught the next flight, the connecting flight to my destination, which was Toronto. Now, imagine what is happening. People, in my case from India, Africa, the Far East, they were boarding this wide-bodied jetliner. They could have breakfast in the city from where they were departing, you know, whether it was Bombay, whether it was Singapore, whether it was, you know, somewhere in China or in Africa. They could have their breakfast there, and they would be having their dinner in Toronto or Vancouver or Montreal, you know, and they had arrived in Canada. It was not months of travel. It was not months of, you know, hard work to get here. They got here, and they were connected to the world they had left behind through television and through radio and through telephone. The world had become, if you remember what Marshall McLuhan had talked about, a global village.
Right.
And so you were simply moving from one city in this global village to another city in this global village, even though they were two different sovereign states, but you were moving. And the people who arrived in Canada or who arrived in Western Europe, they were not being asked by the country where they arrived to become, as immigrant, to become citizen. They were not being asked. In Canada, at least, they were not being asked, okay, you are now in Canada, you have to become Canadian, and these are our values, and, you know, we are your host country. We are accepting you, and it is now your part of the equation to accept the values of the host country and become Canadian. Instead of saying that, we said, the Canadians said, that is, multiculturalism said, welcome, you're Punjabi, you are Sikh, you are Arab, you are Japanese, you are African, whatever, welcome, you're in Canada, now you can go on remaining and doing whatever you want to do in terms of your own culture.
Right.
So we started started creating in our country, Canada, basically ghettos and silos where people would live and work and grow, but who would not necessarily get to know each other or would necessarily engage with each other. And George Jonas, a name you might know, George Jonas, who died a few years ago, great author. He was of Hungarian origin. You know, he escaped the Hungarian Revolution of 1956 and came to Canada and became a wonderful, wonderful writer, movie producer, and so on and so forth, a man of great accomplishment, Order of Canada. He died a few years ago. I became his friend, and he became my mentor. He once said in one of his columns that what we have turned Canada into is into a hotel, one big hotel, you know.
Yeah.
It's not a country, it's a hotel where people come, they live, they enjoy, they take whatever it is to their advantage and their benefit, and then, you know, they go away or they live their life as they live in a hotel. And that's where we have arrived in the Western world. We have turned our country, our history, into a doormat, welcoming others instead of asking others to respect us.
Absolutely. You know, any time that you have one culture coming into another culture, and that culture is not going to assimilate to the host culture, you're going to have dissension in society.
Absolutely.
And that's exactly what has happened. You know, I look at cultures and the cultures that come to our country, And, you know, they stay together as a unit. They're very, very strongly bonded. I could talk about multiple cultures that have come to Canada and now have a culture within inside a culture. Well, that is cultural genocide. And that's exactly what's happening in Canada. Whether I can turn that around or you can turn that around or we can turn that around, Salim, is a big question, but that's exactly what's going on.
That's right. And that's how in the last 50 years, the elite has abandoned their own nation state. That is, the Western elites have abandoned their own nation state. I mean, look at it. I mean, the case of our mother country in the historical sense, that is Britain. In 2016, the people of Britain had a referendum organized by their government on making decision whether they want to remain as a part of the European Union or leave the European Union. And the people decided by a majority vote that they want to leave the European Union. And now, almost 3.5-4 years later, they haven't still left, because their elite, that is their government, it doesn't matter the Conservative or the Labour or what have you, they have connived and colluded and worked to basically nullify the people's decision. So where is our democracy? Who are the people? Where is the sovereignty? It doesn't matter, because the elite has turned everything on its head. And that's exactly what is happening in Canada. That's what was happening in the United States, except for Donald Trump stepped in the middle, you know, to sort of at least temporary derailment of that process of the elite abandoning their country. In fact, the elite is ashamed of the people of their own country.
Absolutely.
Don't care about them, you know, and they find it that, you know, as they go around about the world, you know, that they rather belong to the planet Earth and not to Canada or United States or Britain. So it is virtue signaling about how much they care about planet Earth, while their own people, they are ready to ignore and trample upon.
Absolutely. If you were sitting down in a think tank 60 years ago and you wanted to destabilize the world to the point where we can implement a one world government, the first thing you would do is attack the beacons of freedom on the planet at that particular time, which would, of course, be North America. You'd undermine that society. You would invade that society. You'd attack their health. You'd attack the education system. You'd attack everything that made that country great. And that's exactly what we've seen go on in the last 40, 50, 60 years. You know, what's going on right now, Salim, was thought of 50, 60 years ago in think tanks, where people sit down for hours and they plan what's going to be happening in 2018, 2019. And we're there now. This didn't happen overnight.
Right. I mean, the progressive movement in the Western world, going all the way back to Woodrow Wilson, was about creating a one world government. And that is closer and closer to being achieved in our lifetime as we see it, you know.
So
that's happening. The one world government, that is, whether it was the League of Nations before World War II or now the United Nations after World War II, the Western elite, those who are for one world government, they see that the United Nations, and before that, the League of Nations, is a higher source of legitimacy for the political power than the nation state within which the constitutional framework gives them the legitimacy. And so that's where they have shifted. They rather use that United Nations as an instrument to legitimize their power, all the way down to the municipal level, to the, you know, to the town hall, to the school boards, what they're being taught, what they're learning, and what and how the future is being prepared for the children at that level.
Yeah, it's being implemented at the ground level, and it's all through our society, yet people still don't see it, Salim. So it's very important that we try to educate people, because, like I said in the previous hour, a lot of people still think the United Nations is a good word. And I'll tell you, it's so far from that, that once you start looking into it, you'll really be able to tie it all together and understand what's going on today. We're in a lot of trouble. And I don't know what the future is going to bring, but I know that right now it's very, very important that we have these conversations, even though they're...
My own sense, Barry, is, you know, historically, my own sense is the Western world has reached a tipping point, and we might have, in a sense, gone over the tipping point where Canada is. This 2019 election, I hope we have another chance to talk about it and the result. This 2019 election, I believe, was a tipping point, you know.
I agree.
And we might have, I don't know whether we will be able to pull back sufficiently to defend our national sovereignty, to restore our constitutional system of government, to make our political elite accountable and responsible to the people. I don't know whether we will succeed in getting those things back. 2019 election was, in one sense, the last conversation. And what happened, Barry, was I was a PPC candidate in London. What happened was we saw, you and I saw, and before we lose this memory remains fresh in our head. We need to dissect it and talk about it. We saw the establishment parties, and I would put the Liberals, the Conservatives, the New Democrats, and the Green, they're all establishment parties. They're all basically have conceded to and willingly accommodated the globalist and Islamist agenda. Mm-hmm. And the only party that is outside of the establishment party, in fact, it is the anti-establishment party, was the People's Party of Canada. And the establishment party, with the media and the academia, did a scorched earth policy to nip in the bud the PPC. You know, they saw this as the biggest threat to them, and they nipped a PPC in the bud. I'm not quite sure that they have fully succeeded, because I think there is a willingness to resist the establishment, and the seed the PPC has sown might sprout, but I don't know how strong the sprouting is going to be to take on the establishment party and reverse the situation, you know.
Well, if we don't, Salim, if we don't, then the country's lost, okay? I know that. You know that. And I'm still in shock over this election. I am a big supporter of Maxime Bernier. The fundamentals laid down by the party would have turned this country around. And what happened? We know that the establishment has tremendous control on the media, on the fact on all assets of our society.
Absolutely.
Now. Right to the bottom of our police forces, they have control. We are in a fascist dictatorship, and I say that, and I honestly believe that, but I still believe in the will of the Canadian people, that if we can get them educated and get them off their butts, we can put a stop to this. Because if we don't, we have truly lost this country, Salim.
Amen, Barry. I am with you. You know, we are on the same page, and we need to deepen and broaden this conversation, because I believe, and that's why I ran as a candidate for PPC. I have a backstory on that. You know, about what and where the Conservative Party is, but yeah. That is for a future conversation if you have. But I believe that the remedy to our situation was pretty much laid out by Maxime Bernier and the PPC platform. And the establishment saw that as a huge threat if the people understood it. And so it was a scorched earth policy to destroy the PPC.
Absolutely. And I saw the attacks, and we heard about what Scheer did and all that other, you know, all the shenanigans going on behind the scenes. And I'm just praying, Salim, that we can turn it around, because my children are going to be raised in this country, and my grandchildren. And I know what country I've grown up in and what I've appreciated in my lifetime. And I see it absolutely being destroyed right now. So I guess my last thoughts today would be out to anybody out there that's listening that, you know, this isn't a time to sit down. This isn't a time to be silent. Yeah. Nobody's going to fix these problems but yourself. You have to look in the mirror and really ask yourself, what kind of a legacy I'm leaving on this planet for my children? These are really, really hard questions I ask people to ask of themselves today. I thank you for joining me, sir. In the last minute here, why don't you share with people where they can find you and follow what you're doing? And it's been a pleasure having you on, my friend.
Barry, thank you so much for inviting me. And I look forward to, again, if we get another opportunity to speak to each other. Thank you so much.
Guaranteed. God bless. Yeah, so I'll make a point, sir, of having you back here in the very near future. I've enjoyed this conversation. There's a lot of rabbit holes that we didn't get go down today, but there's so many rabbit holes out there, Salim. You need a week to talk about them all, you know?
Yes.
But you know what? Right. They're all connected, my friend. Every single one is connected.
That's true. That's true. And thank you so much, and God bless you, Barry. God bless you.
Well, thank you, sir, for joining me.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Well, folks, I've to say I enjoyed today's show would be an understatement. I promise to get these gentlemen back in the very near future. Absolutely a great conversation. I hope we shared some good information with you today. And I hope that you really do stand in front of the mirror and ask yourself what you can do at this particular point in your life to get involved and stop this madness that you see. I don't think anything is more important in my life right now, and I hope you do the same way. Thanks for joining me today. It's been a great show, and I'll be back next week again, same time, same place. God bless you all. Have a great week. Love you, and bye for now.